suffer.
And you know, when I tell people the story that he wrote, it was that Putin, as a young boy,
right,
lived next to...
He lived in the same apartment, right, with Ehrlich.
People don't believe it. They say it couldn't have been.
They go online and find his address to the World Jewish Congress of Russia, whatever it's called. And there he breaks down and cries. He speaks about, you're going to tell me what the Talmud is? Mr. Ehrlich studied Talmud all of Shabbat, all of Shabbos. He describes, he says, I was at Kiddush. It's unbelievable. And it's unbelievable because the same individual can, it's like the mafia. If you used to say about the mafia, they could kill you by day, by night, but they're good to their mothers. Mm-hmm. You follow? That was the expression.
Why didn't the KGB arrest Mr. Ehrlich? Why did you let him?
No, he did nothing wrong.
He was engaging in religious practice.
You're allowed. If you're over the age of 18, you can engage. Chabad continued. There were limits. You couldn't, if you bar mitzvah a kid, it was illegal, because you're forcing a kid under 18 to...
But for you yourself, you could do whatever you
want. You do whatever you want. According to the law, again, he was a high school teacher. He was a good teacher. He was the wrestler. Putin cried at his funeral. There are eyewitnesses. Go online, you can get a... I heard it in Shvatami. I heard it in Russia. Mina Berliner, I knew she's Jewish. I knew everything. In Russia, a year ago... They told me she came from a very prominent Chabad family. Everyone knew the family. But it's overwhelming. It hurts. It hurts. Imagine we're happy that he died in battle. You understand what I'm saying? But at least I remember Miriam saying, who knows if he's freezing in prison. Okay. Mindaf Kein Vayda. As much as it hurts, we did what we could. All right, I have to thank Aleit Sahal. I would have never opened my mouth. Of course, there were, what I spoke about, not exactly for public knowledge, but if they can talk about it, I can talk about it. The secrets, I didn't reveal the word. You follow me? That, let it be. Maybe in 50 years, it can be written, it can be researched, and the secrets can be revealed. But, all right, Baruch Hashem. But the army, I looked in... In the Kari Shon, they write how the army now changed its policy, and as you saw with the last war, the two people missing, they declared him dead right away. So you can put in a footnote there, thank Aaron Rakefet for this new policy. You follow? Baruch Hashem. All right, I don't need credit. Let's just go further. Okay, as far as yesterday's Shia, I may or may not have made a small mistake. I just want to... the person of responsible, the Balei Tosfot, from the end of the period, from Verona, is Rebbe Eliezer of Verdun. I may have said Rebbe Yitzchak. There was another one, but the one for Avad Zichro is Rebbe Eliezer. And people asked me afterwards, and this morning I was asked...
And you said Yitzchak, yeah.
I said Yitzchak, so I made a mistake. Change it to Eliezer. And this dawned upon me in my sleep. Amazing, in my sleep. People asked me to explain more about Zichro. Look, I can't go into it. It would take me half a year to go in. But if you're interested, beginning on page 75 of Rakafet Aram Chelek Gimel, I go into great detail. It's written up from the shirim I gave in the Kollel years ago, decades ago. And there you have all the information. Now, before I begin, I want to relate to an issue that still hangs fire, and I want to thank Sidney Gottesman, the great-grandson of Reb Mendel. He sent me the entire file from the president's house on Tenuat Kach v'Rav Meir Kahana. So I went through the whole file, and I have to tell you, the president took the letter very seriously. If it was a forgery, President Herzog took it very seriously. He writes back. I have the letter where he writes back. Lichvold Maran. He knows who the Rav is. And also, carbon copies, he sends a carbon copy of his letter to Yosef Borg. It says, at the bottom, CC, Yosef Borg. So it shows you President Herzog took it seriously. What's very interesting... And I went through the whole file, and a lot of people wrote letters, a lot of people. All they got as an answer was a form letter. Dear so-and-so, I'm the secretary of the president. I'm happy to let you know he received your letter and he will consider your kind thoughts. Sincerely, signed the name, whatever the name was, assistant to the president. The letter back to the Rav is a very detailed letter. And there he explains why he refused to seek a Hana and why he saw the Arab murderers. He says, Kahana is endangering the life of the Jews that are still left in the Arab countries. You can't talk this way. They're Jews in the Arab countries. We have to be careful what we say. Number two, the president says that 10% of the Israeli population, 15% are Arabs. The more Kahana talks this way, the more we have extremism among the Israeli Arabs. In halachic language, maset hakelef. So then he makes a third point that I've told Mayor Kahana that he will, if he will revise his public stance, I will reconsider meeting with him. So you see, it's a very fascinating letter. The other letters, President Herzog didn't bother to explain himself at all, just a form letter. Mm-hmm. To the Rav, he explained himself. All right, I got more correspondence today. I haven't had a chance to read it. It's correspondence from the last few days. Sherry only came in late yesterday, and I left here before 12, quite exhausted from the shiur. But I have to read. There's more correspondence on the Kahana letter. But be it as it may, I can tell you with absolute certainty, after going through the file, and I thank Sidney Gottesman immensely. I keep on saying Sidney Goldstein because I had a classmate in Rabbi Volkshirer, Rabbi Sidney Goldstein, who is my classmate. So that's the first Sidney Gold. It's Sidney Gottesman I want to mention. I thank him immensely for sending me the file. Now, coming back to Rabbi Young, and today will be a very fascinating Shia, and it's capturing Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. So Sidney sent me Rabbi Young's hesped for his great-grandfather, Mr. Mendel Gottesman. And here, at the end of the hesped, this is Rabbi Young. You'll see someone, the insight. He says, yes, I venture to say, if your grandfather were to utter his last will to his beloved children, he would say to you, and then he goes on what Mr. Mendel Gottesman would say on his deathbed. And here's what I want to read to you. Whatever I leave you as a Yerusha or inheritance is of passing significance in the history of our people. He's referring to him, you know, by today's standards, this man was a billionaire. It may be increased in the process of life or decreased, but what I leave to you as my morasha, you follow, Yerusha versus morasha, or heirloom, not to be spent, but to be transmitted as our title of nobility for future generations, I pray that you keep this as your most precious asset. So you see, this is Rabbi Young. And it gives you insight to who Mr. Mendel Gottesman was. And even though from that generation, many of the famous names have very few descendants, if any, who are Shema Torah Mitzvot, in the Gottesman family, there's an entire branch, Makpid Kula Kachamura, wonderful, wonderful Jews, some already living in Israel, so we can look back with joy. The man did in his lifetime, and his children honored him in his death. Now, coming back, let's pick up with Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. And we spoke last week how this man went all over the world in Joint Distribution Committee. We spoke about the Balabatim, and are you happy when your rabbi travels? And this is an open issue. I can't, you know, everything depends upon individual circumstances. But Leo Young had the mazel that in Jewish Center, you had Balabatim who were world-class people, whose money and thinking and worry and concern went way beyond the Dalet Amot of 86th Street. And therefore, when the rabbi traveled all over the world, they rejoiced. And he also had, we'll come to that later or next time we meet, he also had the mazel to have Rabbi Joe Kamenetsky, to have Dr. Joe Kamenetsky on his staff in Jewish Center. So there was a well-known rabbinic figure, Talmud Chacham. I don't think he ever had smicha per se, but a yeshiva college graduate, Talmud Chacham, Yorei V'Shalem. So there was someone to turn to, and there were other people on the staff. So he could be all over the world, and the Balabatan rejoiced. Unlike the example I gave you with Bernstein, Yitzchak, what was his first name? Rabbi Dr. Louis Bernstein. Unlike the example with Louis Bernstein, where I say he was president, you had a wonderful rabbi, and boy, he wanted to chop my head off. Yeah, he was a wonderful rabbi when he traveled and was away from the shul. And I can't criticize. I understand the president. He's paying him a salary to be in the shul, etc. Now, let me move further. With all that Rabbi Young did, he lives with one tremendous contradiction. And this contradiction I saw when I came in Aliyah 50 years ago, it was tangible here in the state of Israel as well. And this is very simple. Logically speaking, if Charlie and Morty and Vic were alive 125 years ago, and here the Zionists are talking, we're going to build a state, we're going to build a state, whose side did you have been on? Zionists are going to Israel. You're hearing stories. Mechalalei Shabbos. Ochlei Nevelet and Trefat. Whose side would you have been on? And here you have Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael, and you got to give Agudat Yisrael credit at that time until Rav Shach, what happened here in the 1980s, of course, changed the picture. But Agudat Yisrael brought together Litvakin, Chassidim, and Yekesher Rabbanim. And this was a fabulous achievement. And more information has come out by way in Chakira. The latest Chakira, Yaakov Sasson, my sub-Talmud, again, going into the whole reason why Reb Chaim refused to be an Agudist. And it's amazing that Aguda people tried to squelch this research, didn't want it published, it was ready years ago, but didn't want it published because they tell the world Reb Chaim Brisker, one of the founding theologians of Agudat Yisrael. And I told you why. And by the way, the story I'm telling, I heard from the family. Yaakov Sasson did not mention this story, but I heard it time and again from various members of the family. And I'll repeat the story. It's worth repeating. It's a fabulous story. But it captures the difficulty in bringing these people together. And the story is, what's your first name? Our new Tarragon, Herbie. Also, doctor, we don't use titles, doctor, schmachter, forget about titles. At your age, if you need a title, you're in bad shape, you follow? I just told that to my doctor, who we were discussing, whether you call him Dr. Rosen, Dr. Ephraim, Rebunish, but if someone needs a title, gesunte hate, give them a title, whatever. You know, I remember Reb Chaim 1912, they were talking Aguda, they held the preliminary conferences, couldn't be held like today. Today, you pick up a phone, they call Herbie and Flatbush, come to Israel, we're having a conference of dentists, a new technique next Thursday. This is Tuesday, he's on the plane, Wednesday's here, Thursday, and he meets all my relatives who are dentists. Fine. Those years, 1912, they're planning. They're first going to have the big convention in 1914, which never took place because World War I broke out and many people were stranded on their way to the conference. So Reb Chaim comes, and Reb Chaim walks out in anger. So they ask Reb Chaim, Rebbe, was is given? What happened? Was is eich gechepet azay? It's hard to translate these words. Do you know Yiddish, Herbie?
Yeah.
Baruch Hashem. I got from the previous...
I'm with English, but Yiddish.
Yiddish, no problem. Good. Was hat eigentlich gechepet, I say. So Reb Chaim told the story, says... I'll tell you a story, Reb Chaim says. There was this little shtetl in Lithuania, and there was a grocery store. And the lady came in to buy, and the kid working there was a challenged young man. And she says, what's the price of the tomatoes? He says, it's 2 rubles. What's the price of the potatoes? 2 rubles. What's the price to place the cucumbers? 2 rubles. So she goes over to the owner of the store and says, Versteinisch, Dalses, everything is 2 rubles? So he says, lady, this fellow can't speak. He doesn't know much. But he can only say 2 rubles. Don't take him seriously. I'll tell you the price when you're ready to check out. Reb Chaim said, I'm like this challenge kid. Ich bin ein Zewider Kind. Ich kann nur sagen 2 rubles. Bei mir, the 2 rubles is Trader. And he says, and I heard this German rabbi, Charlie, no offense, man. I heard this German rabbi get up to speak, and he says, et geret a halb shah und nicht de mund ein maimer chazal. Spoke a half hour, didn't mention one maimer chazal. It's not for me. Ich kann nur ein Wort zwei. I walked down, and I heard this story from Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. I heard this story from Reb Yosef, the son of Reb Aaron Soloveitchik. So it's a true story, and there was no. But it shows you, despite Reb Chaim's attitude, by the time Agudat Yisrael got off the floor in 1919, he was no longer alive. It united all Jews. 90%. Munkach was not there, Sakma was not there, but 90%. Then they had to make a decision about Zionism. So they made a decision that anyone who believes in Zionism, anyone who believes there can be a Jewish state, be a sovereignty, Jewish sovereignty before Mashiach Zidkenu, was an absolute apikoros. And that was their decision. I hate to say it, if we were back 125 years ago, I'm not certain we wouldn't agree with this decision. How can you make your peace with Chilul Shabbos, Nevelet and Treifus, and everything that went on near the Kinneret? You understand where Israel begins? All right, I refer you to my Shurim on Zionism. I give you an unbelievable answer with sources that no one has ever been able to negate my answer. But that's not important. The question is more important than the answer now. So many people were not Zionists. You take the 6th Lubavitcher Rebbe, 100% anti-Zionist. The 7th Rebbe never sang HaTikvah in his life. And Rakefet claims the biggest Zionist in the world was Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the 7th Rebbe. But he never sang HaTikvah in his life. So you take people like Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, coming from Hungary, Germany, England. He was an anti-Zionist. But then life unfolds. Ribbono shel Olam, they start building Palestine. Hitler comes to power. The war, the 6 million, the gates that are open. Do I have to go any further than Mori Urevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the greatest Zionist in the world? Where did he begin? He began as a 100% Agudist. Right or wrong? And after World War II, Koldo Dido Fake, we're sitting here because of Koldo Dido Fake. So you see, Pole Agudat Yisrael became the greatest solution. Herbie, you knew the son of one of the founders of Pole Agudat Yisrael. Remember? Minz. Didn't you know that person who lived? Right, the guy with the ponytail, with the kippah. His father was one of the founders.
Your neighbor, I know.
These were people who absolutely opposed Zionism, but they saw the reality. So to become a Mizrahiite, I have to tell you, I don't want to mention the name, but Bididi Haviyuvda, I've established my credit after Galei Tzahal spoke about me, so I can get away and tell you the truth, and it is the truth. When I was in a certain country, so one of the biggest Agudah leaders there wanted to meet me. So I asked the people who sponsored me, should I take off a day and meet with him? He wants to take me out, show me around. They said, absolutely, he's a very important person. And we hit it off, and I can't mention the name, but his father, his grandfather, his uncle, his brother, we're dealing with one of the most prominent Agudah families in the world outside of Israel. And in his privacy, let me use the word as they pronounce it, in the privacy of his study, he breaks down and tells me late that afternoon, he says, Reb Aaron, you have truth. I do not. So I said to him, what's the problem? join us. He says, how can I join you? My father, my wife's family, my brother. I said, if you want truth, you have to break and join. If you know what happened? His father died. His father died of aggravation here. He had said something in England, in Europe, that was a little open-minded. He came to Israel. There were Paschvilis up already putting him in Chayrim. And his father was 100% Agudat Yisrael. So after his father died, I couldn't believe my ears. He listened to half of what I said. Join me. He joined me ideologically, but didn't come to Israel. He winds up in the other end of the United States, very prominent today in religious Zionist circles. All right. Poli Aguda was the fabulous answer. Technically speaking, Poli Aguda are not Zionists. We're a good distinct. Binyamin Mintz was a Gera Chassid. On a practical level, there was absolutely no difference between Poli Aguda, their education, their children, their kibbutzim, shalavim, chafetz chayim, the army, nachal. There was a nachal dati that was one half Poli Aguda. And their greatest supporter in America was Rabbi Dr. Leo Young. See, that hat of Poli Aguda, he could wear b'kavod gadol. When I started teaching in Michalah in 1971, the original faculty of Michalah was almost all Poli Aguda. They were tremendous Zionists and tremendous Agudistas. It was a different world then. The Mizrahi people looked like Rakefet, clean shaven, mutton dress, Poli Aguda, beards, payas, not such mutton dress, but halacha lemaisa, there was no difference. Ultimately, what happened is Poli Aguda disappeared. And Poli Aguda disappeared for the simple reason each generation moves on. By the time you have a third generation from the Poli Aguda Knicks, you want to be an Zionist? The Chadalim are more from than anyone in the world. Charedim Datiyim Liumiyim. You go to Yehuda Vishomrim, you go to Beit El, Ribbono Shel Olam, you can be the firmest person in the world today and be a Zionist. So the Poli Aguda descendants, a minority wind up in Panovich, but a majority wind up very strongly in the Tzioni Dati Chardali world in particular. So, but in the 50s, into the 60s, the 70s, the people like Leo Young. Give me another example that you should know. I mentioned in class, Fabian Schoenfeld. That's the famous story at the Poli Aguda convention when they elected Fabian Schoenfeld president of Poli Aguda in America. There's no greater Zionist than Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. Half his family or more lives here in Israel. But he was raised, the Gera Chassid, that tradition. They were anti-Zionists, they were Poli Aguda. Still the name Aguda, but Poli Aguda. And that's that when he was elected. Remember what happened when he was elected president? The Jew got up and shouted out, Fabian, was for a nomen for a rav? What kind of name for a rabbi? Fabian. And Rav Lezer Silva cut him off and said, "If Rabbeinu Peter had gehasen Rabbeinu Peter, unser Choshev Rav Rav Schoenfeld ken se gehasen Fabian." Rabbeinu Peter, Rabbeinu Tam's top Talmud, Peter, Rabbi Peter, that was Rav Lezer Silva. Now, once he became attached to Poli Aguda, he became very active. He established Klal Yahu. This is a whole area. It's called Pieland. It's near, on the way to Ashkelon, beyond Beit Shemesh, on the way to Ashkelon, Ashdod. Pieland, Pei Aleph Yud, Poli Aguda land. It's a play on words. Pieland. One settlement after another, either a kibbutz or a moshav. And then Klali Yahu, you have a tremendous institution for women educating from high school on, a teacher's seminary. Today, it's not as, today all these institutions for women that were established in the 60s, in the early 70s perhaps, they're not as big as they used to be. And it's a one simple reason. See, you take Michlala, Michlala today runs many postgraduate programs, including for men. So you'll ask, why did they get involved? They run ads, Michlala Gam LeGevarim. Because on the bachelor's level, they don't have the same clientele. Today, no one's afraid of going to the university. It's a different world today. If you went to the university in the 60s, you might have been the only religious girl in every class you attended. Today, there's so many religious people in the universities that you all know. Hebrew U, the students demanded student day when they hulava all night. And I was at my the Technion visiting my grandchildren, and they're delivering 1,000 cases of beer. So I asked my grandson, what's going on here? He said, this is students' night today. Students' day, they stay up all night drinking, singing. It's like any geisha university. Student, where I come from, students want to celebrate, stay up all night with a mishmah, learning Torah. But all right, these universities, they demanded at Hebrew U for the religious children, youngsters, boys and girls separate. Remember what went on here a year ago? Who would ever dream that at Hebrew U they're going to demand separate for men and separate for women the whole of a student's day? But Klal Yahu in its prime was a major institution. Rabbi Young was overjoyed. It catered to women from, hold on one second, South Tel Aviv, Dimona, Yeruchim, all these settlements that were called secondary Israel. Not only that, the early 80s, they took in a whole group of Ethiopian girls, and this was his pride. The people in Jewish Center reacted with joy, and by the 1980s, there were no less than 20 annual prizes. In other words, the Charlie, Dr. Charlie Hexter Prize for Excellence in Chemistry. 20 prizes created by Balabatim in Jewish Center. Rabbi Leo Young, all the royalties of his Hebrew publications went to Kfar Eliyahu. For the boys, Yad Binyamin. You've heard of Yad Binyamin? All right. He was one of the founders, one of those that pushed, created fabulous achievements, Poli Agudat Yisrael. Oh, no, I'm an anti-Zionist. I don't believe in this. I don't believe in that. On the ground... what are you referring to? Yad Binyamin is named after Binyamin Mintz, of course. See, Binyamin Mintz is a very sad story, which I told Charlie, which I told Herbie Maltz, I shouldn't say Charlie. I told Herbie one time walking to shul on the Rehov Palmach, he was a Ger Chassid. And there was a whole question of the politics of the government. I need not tell you politics here plays a very big role. When we vote tomorrow, you're not just voting for Trump or Obama or whoever you're voting for. You're voting for Torah, essentially. Your vote has a big impact on what the future of this country will be from a Torah stance. And there was a question of forming a government. This goes back to Ben-Gurion. And the Poli Aguda went with the Avodah, the labor, and formed the government. They went into the government, they took ministerships, and Agudat Yisrael was furious. They didn't want to go. You can check it out. I don't recall what the issue was, but Agudat Yisrael didn't want to go. Poli Aguda went, and then Binyamin Mintz wanted to see his Rebbe, and his Rebbe refused to see him. And he died soon afterwards of a heart attack. A young man.
Was
a young man.
He's
put paschvayas against him. I don't know if you can say a formal chayrim, but he went through hell. No, I was put into chayrim in 1974, Michalai. You can check it all out. I was put into chayrim. I was in good company, Rabbi Cooperman and Rabbi Breuer. And yours truly, it seems that we published the catalog in Michlala, and someone showed it to Rav Shach, and he went berserk that Rabbi Koopman shows how to refute biblical criticism. I remember he wrote, in the Cherem, he wrote, Who says that the students will believe the refutation? Mm-hmm. They'll believe the biblical criticism. And Rabbi Breuer, of course, for many decades already has been in Cheirim because of his approach to Kitvei Yad with the Chumash and everything. And Rakefet, they saw what I was teaching, the advanced, the students, the postgraduate. Women have to know, Dinei Aguna, have to know, Avad Zichro, have to know topics like this. Oh, Rabbi Hassan, no. When you, so you wrote a cheirim against me, you made me famous, you put me into the limelight. Oh, with all due respect to Rav Shach, I know his son and I were bosom buddies, classmates in graduate school. We got our doctorates a year apart, with all due respects. But for chassid, when your Rebbe refuses to see you, this is earth-shaking, this is terrible. So he died young. And Yad Binyamin is named in his memory. Yes, Yitzchak.
Oh, I think you need to mention, Kfar Eliyahu is named for Leo Young.
Yes, named for Leo Young, absolutely. And more than that, it's named in his honor, Kfar Eliyahu. And more than that, the friends from Jewish Center, by the 1980s, JNF received onto $300,000 from them, planted a forest in honor of Rabbi Leo and Irma Young Forest in Tzfat, planted, dedicated, July 1983. And I remember reading about it in the newspapers here. Of course, I don't want to be cynical, but if you call the first famous Israeli movie, who knows what name is on the forest today? Remember the movie, Vic?
Slicha Shabbati.
You got to see the movie, but it's a classic. It's an Ephraim Kishon. And what happens is your friends establish the Vixno Forest, and everyone comes and they dedicate, and you go back to America. The next day they're changing the signs. Chaim Yankel from London comes. You got to know fundraising. When my grandson, one of my grandsons, the Technion in the medical school, then he's getting a PhD now in his research, so he's getting an MD. He's a bright young man. When he speaks English, even though he was born here, but his mother, I spoke English, so we wouldn't answer my door. In America, we only spoke Hebrew to our children. In Israel, we only spoke English. So when the girls were growing up, they wanted to speak Hebrew. We would only answer in English. We insisted they have to speak English, which turns out to be a tremendous blessing. That this daughter was later head of the International Committee for Missing Israeli Soldiers, and she had to know English. So her children know English. So you have no idea what would go on. Someone is coming from England, a big donor. He would get a personal program of his stay at the Technion, and your guide will be Mr. Benjamin Eisen. You follow my grandson who spoke English, and he showed him around and here, there, and the fact that he wore a kippah is also an advantage because it's interesting and fun. I know this from another incident where another grandson was offered a fellowship to go to Tel Aviv, Shenkar, instead of Bezalel. Why? And they told him, you wear a kippah in fundraising, when people come in, they can be totally irreligious, but an Israeli kid with a kippah, it speaks to their heart. It says something to them. And he would show them around and everything, and then a week later, someone else get the same show with the dinner, but they would leave a hefty check. But at least there was no forest being planted and names switched. But it would be interesting to know if the forest still bears the name Leo and Irma Young. Now, coming to Kashrut, he got very heavily involved with everything we alluded to earlier when we spoke about the OU. He basically was the founder of what ultimately becomes the Rabbinical Council of America. He is the first, it was called the chairperson. He was, when they become more formal a number of years later, then they elect the president, and he cedes to Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein to take over the local operation of the Kashrut. This was a rabbinic committee under the OU. Later, it is the seeds for the Rabbinical Council of America, which we'll come to in great detail, Be'ezrat Hashem, That's about 10 years later. We're talking now the mid-20s. And here we have the problem that we've lived with and suffered with in this class for a number of years already. If, and remember, the biggest word in the dictionary, the most important word in the dictionary is two letters, I-F. If the Elder Rabbanim would have accepted the YU type, let's use the word Yeshivas Chochanan type rabbis of the 20s, the whole picture of American Orthodoxy would have been different. But I think I told you the story. I once, a Talmud from the Kollel got married, and there were Sheva Brachas, and they asked me to speak at the Sheva. I'm still in touch with this Talmud. He doesn't live in Israel, but he came as a teenager. He never adjusted here. And the rest of his family are all here, but he's in Baltimore. All right, fine. Baltimore's a good city too, but it's not Israel. And I speak at a Sheva Brachas. I can't go into more detail. I can tell you the whole drasha. I remember it like yesterday. It's years ago. So another world-famous Litvisha right-wing Talmud Chacham heard about this affair, and he wanders in uninvited. But when he walks in, they have to be mechaberim to speak. So he gets up and rips the hell out of me. What's that they get at? I can't remember. I think he spoke Yiddish. What's that they get at? What was he talking about? Shas and Paiske, and what the heck does he know? An ignoramus of Bura. It was unbelievable. So that was on Friday morning. Saturday night, Nebuch, the parents and the Chatan, and they all came to my house to apologize that I wish you would have recorded it. I could have sold it to my students. $5 a copy. They would have enjoyed. But we all try to figure out why he jumped on me. He didn't know me from a hole in the ground, and I didn't say anything revolutionary. I quoted the Rav, I quoted the Lubavitcher Rebbe, unless he got upset, I quoted the Rebbe, but it was Divrei Torah, it was beautiful, it was fine, it was good. I told him the answer is he sees a guy without a beard, and without payas, without black hose, he assumes right away you're a boor to the second degree. And this is what the Yudapayash Rabban, and by the way, until today, I don't know the real reason he jumped on me. He's no longer alive. I had other run-ins I saw with him. One time I had a student. If I would write what I've seen in life, I could buy up Grist Campus. But it's about people. You don't want to write. So I had a student, a very wealthy home in Antwerp. Big diamonds. And the parents played the shtick there like they're right wing, and the girl was raised, it was a normal home, but outwardly more right wing. And this girl was brilliant and a real rebellious individual. And she was very close to me. She was a classmate of my eldest daughter, was a bat bayit in my house. She called me Abba, at kedei kach. Vayehi hayom, the boys are lined up from Chevron to marry her. I don't have to tell you how much money there is in the family. And she told them to go, told her father, go fly a kite, take these boys with you. And she married whom she wanted. It happened to be a nephew of a very good friend of mine. And there's the wedding in Yerushalayim, lunch wedding. Big suder at night, the first Sheva Brachas in the Hilton in Tel Aviv. Ein ani yud b'mokam ashirot. And here they invite the rabbi of Antwerp, the same rabbi I'm talking about, to speak. And he speaks in Yiddish. And this girl was furious. Her chatan grew up in Israel, doesn't know a word of Yiddish. He can speak English. He lived in Chicago for many years. He can speak Hebrew. Yiddish. Oh, you can't believe the fight that broke out there. Leave it at that. So I've seen this person in battle a number of times, once against my student and once against her teacher, her Rebbe. Fine. Had the Agudas HaRabbanim Rabbanim accepted the new American rabbi, there would have never been this breach. There would have never been, for years, until well after World War II, the Agudas HaRabbanim versus Rabbinical Council. But the Agudas Rabbanim Rabbanim looked upon Rakefet and his ilk. What are these American kids? Schnipp Yinglach? Was kennen sie? No, I got smicher at the age of 23, so I knew 100 daf gemara. Maybe, all right, I'll give myself more credit. Dov, I knew 200 daf gemara. You follow? How many daf did you know when you got smicha? All right. And they looked up, and Amarich, what a boor, what's this, harika? All right, you got to know. Rakefet today, don't want to talk. Going through Shas a third time, Allah say the leaving out all the shayrim, all the chidushim, all the publications, all but Bani Shalom. Give credit, all right. They had to waste time in high school. I had to go to high school, shouldn't waste time. I had to go to college, graduate school. But they hold by learning, they can achieve. No, they looked upon them Americanish, not a shirabbanim. And the result was a total split. And this is where Rabbi Young suffered. Because as frum as he was, as dignified as he was, as learned as he was, the Agudat HaRabbanim would never accept him. His heksha, his understanding, his lifestyle, that's not a rabbi. And this is why the OU got involved in Kashrut. The greatest achievement in the modern Torah scene, in my humble opinion, is the OU and organized Kashrut. You have no idea how thankful we can be that we can travel all over the world and find what to eat. And I can testify, I was in Cairns, Australia, which is the end of the world. Look at a map. You think you're falling off into the Pacific Ocean. You're finished. You're going to wind up swimming to Japan. And even in Cairns, you go into the supermarket, kosher products. Kosher products from Melbourne, from Sydney, from all over the world, from France, from the United States. You go to Hong Kong, endless kosher products, wherever you go, wherever you go. The OU, and then it gave birth to the Chaf K, it gave birth to the OK. I don't want to say the OU is the only organization. It gave birth to Rabbi Heinemann's organization. But the concept of public service, this begins with the OU. And Rabbi Young, Rabbi Goldstein as well, obviously, these people are responsible. Communal supervision. And that's why the OU needed a rabbinical body, because the Balabatim could handle the money. But the rabbis have to handle the kashrut. And in this biography of Rabbi Young, the author describes, and this captures it, one prominent, kind, and gentle rabbi exploded with rage when years later he heard the name of Rabbi Young. For he blamed Young for the fact that his family had been driven out of the kashrut supervision business by the reforms, quote, of Young. And I don't have to tell you, this is absolutely true. And this, I have to say, to the greatness of the OU and all the other major kashrut organizations follow this example. It's called the grandfather clause. You know what I'm referring to? When the OU took over Hashgacha that had been in the hands of private rabbis for the sake of argument, Chalap and Reichman. When I was growing up, Rabbis Chalap and Reichman, that kashrut was all over the place, all right? In the Reichman family, there's nothing left. There were two sons, one was challenged, the other one is a great Talmud Chacham, they both live in Israel, they have nothing to do with kashrut. The Rabbi Rafal Reichman is in the Briska community, nothing to do with American kashrut, but the Rabbi Chalap branch left people. So if you notice, let's take Rabbi Zvulun Chalap. He gave up the Hechsher on Pepsi Cola. It was taken over by the Chaf K, if I have my facts right. If not, you can correct me. It doesn't matter, but the example is perfect. And the grandfather clause. Kol Zman that Rabbi Chalap lives, he gets his regular fee as Rav HaMachshir. The standards and the work on the ground is part of the greater Chaf K operation. But they don't want to harm the person who inherited and has the schut. Continue. Time marches on, and then it becomes totally the Chaf K with no outsider involved. And that's known as the grandfather clause. If your grandfather or father was giving the Hechsher and you inherited it, we don't want to force you out. And that's why I cry when it comes to Hebrew National, when Rabbi Stern died and Rabbi Raubach took over and Rabbi Raubach Sr. and then Rabbi Raubach Jr., who today happens to be my Talmud from the 60s, who today runs it, they turned to the OU. They wanted the OU to take over. In other words, it would have been with the grandfather's clause. The descendants would not have lost money during their lifetime. But it would have been an OU Heksha with the OU standards. And sadly, the OU didn't take it, and I found out why. Because the OU made a decision decades ago that any meat Heksha has to be glut. The reason is not halachic, it's financial. This was explained to me. When you give a Heksha today in New York, you have to have something that the Hungarians are going to eat, and the Sfadim are going to eat. The Sfadim, I used to hear from Moshe Rebbe time and again, the Rav used to say, Mintracht as ba Sfadim is Sada Sach Kulis, the Sfadim a lot of Kulis. He says, Zeh haben ein Chumra versus Ret al Kulis. They have one Chumra that knocks out all their Kulis, that they mak peranglat. They don't take the Bedikat like we do with the lungs, you know, where you touch it and see, etc., etc. They don't accept that. So they have to have glut. The Hungarians have a chumra with glut. The Rav never ate glut in his life. You can ask people in Europe, in Litvisha, who ever heard of glut? It was unheard of. Who could afford glut? They everyone ate kosher with bedikat, with all the halachat and hilchat treifat. But, so why didn't they take it over? Because Manny Holes, as Zecher Tzadik Livracha, told me, the Zav Kashrut, Manny said to me, Aaron, we don't have enough source of glut in America. It would have been impossible to keep our standards, and we didn't want to compromise. I think it was a mistake. I would have established a new slaughterhouse. There are plenty of Satmar Shechtim and Lubavitcher Shechtim who need panasa. They're not doctors, they're not rabbis, they're not dentists, they're not PhDs, they're not chemists, etc., etc.
Where he remembers my day, I love a show.
Right.
He would say in Europe,
I'm not certain. That's good gesagt. So this was.
Glot Yosher.
God, listen, you have to. There's no two ways. I still remember David Hartman. He still was from a Lakewood boy. Remember him screaming in the yeshiva. They issued, it's ancient history already. But in the early 50s, some yeshiva boys put out a 4-volume shas. Remember, they weren't sperm available. And they went bankrupt. They took orders, and they never filled them. So I remember David Hartman screaming in the Beit Medrash, I'm positive they eat glot kosher. But their business dealings should be glut. And I remember him screaming, but that was a David Hartman that I knew, not the one that he morphs into later. All right, let me go further with Rabbi Young. I want to finish this part today. Rabbi Young had another trait that anyone who came into contact with him was overwhelmed. He was a very kind individual. And here, he attracted some of the leading thinkers in the Torah world related to him as their Rebbe, plain and simple. Here you have a name that many of you will not recognize, Milton Konovitz, Professor Konovitz, K-O-N-V-I-T-Z, Milton Konovitz. Recognize the name? Milton Konovitz was the son of Rav Yosef Konovitz of Newark. Rabbi Yosef Konovitz was the son-in-law of the Ritbaz of Slutsk, afterwards Chicago, afterwards New York, afterwards Tzvat. I know the family personally. You may have known Brent. They were in New Jersey, but not Newark. They were further north. But the Konovitz family. Now, Rav Yosef Konovitz was in Newark. He was in Newark in the 20s, the 30s, when he was in his fame. The kids were raised there. Milton, out of his children, what can I tell you, 4 or 5 generations later, let me not spell it out. Okay, you with me, Dov? You remember the name Kanvich? Ich glaube nicht, dass es da jüdische Mensch auf dem Ort von, on this branch of the family. God have mercy, what America did to us. But Milton Kanvich was a grandson of the Ritbaz, was a son of Rav Yosef Kanvich. He was professor at Cornell University and very, very famous New York State School of Labor Industrial Relations and a professor of law at Cornell University. And he was a Torah Jew, very friendly with the Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman, with Manny Rachman. And Dr. Kanvich, Professor Kanvich, worshipped the ground that Rabbi Young walked on. Rabbi Young is my rabbi too. If he were a Rebbe instead of a rabbi, I would be one of his Hasidim. My feeling for him is close to reverence. And that's from a well-known professor. Whenever he wrote an article which dealt with Jewish sources, before he published, he always gave it to Rabbi Young for his corrections and comments. A name that you all know, Hermann Wouk. Hermann Wouk should live and be well into his hundreds today. This is one of the names written in gold on the American Torah scene. Hermann Wouk grew up in the Bronx, not far from where I grew up. His grandfather was a rabbi in the Bronx. And he was very close to his grandfather. His parents already, his mother, his father, his son-in-law, were not that frum. But he was very close to his grandfather. Typical American kid growing up, Jewish kid in the Bronx in the 30s at that moment in time. One of the stories he writes about, which I think is classic, is the time he's in his grandfather's shul, Aseret Yemei Tshuva, and the grandfather, Minhag Yisrael, you learn a perek of Hilchat Tshuva, the 10 prakim. Each day of Aseret Yemei Tshuva, you learn a perek. So he's sitting there, Balabatim in the Bronx, and his grandfather, and these are Balabatim, I, having grown up in the Bronx, I'm willing to bet you 90% of them worked on Shabbos, but all right, in their old age, they're retired, and his grandfather is trying to impress upon them the need to do Tshuva. And he reads the Rambam and explains, and all your sins are forgiven, everything is blocked out, erased. And they go home after davening, and the little kid Hermann says to his Zayda, Zayda, I don't understand. You have people who all their life are Shema Torah and Mitzvot. And are you saying that some Jew who for 70 years was Mechalel Shabbos, Eidochle Nevelet and Trefot, and then he does Tshuva, they're on the same level? That's what you told the Balabatim today? That's what the Rambam says? And his grandfather explained to him, look, I want them to do Tshuva, I want to encourage them. So I did say they can erase all the bad pages. But there's one big difference. If you live a good Jewish life, so you have 80 pages written in gold. If you live a life like we understand these people are living, you have 70 pages that are totally erased. And then the last 10 pages are in gold. Hermann Wouk, more or less what I'm telling you, he writes it up. It's not my exact language, it's the exact idea. And he was a kid impressed. In the late 30s, as a teenager already, he started to become totally observant, and that's when he met Rabbi Young. And he declared to Rabbi Young, quote, this is in a letter they found in Rabbi Young's archives, that has been my lifelong endeavor to carry out lessons learned from you. And he just loved Rabbi Young. They say that his classic work, This Is My God, that many of the theological hashkafic issues he touches upon were issues he worked out with Rabbi Young. And how did you work out issues with Rabbi Young? Remember, Herman Wouk was in the Navy, the Caine Mutiny, his most famous novel. Then he came back from the Navy. Came back, once again sought out Rabbi Young. Now, Rabbi Young lived a very, very organized life. Pardon the pun, only a yekka could live such an organized life. And every day, he went for a walk in Central Park, many times rain or shine. On this walk, anyone could accompany him and speak to him. It was a time that there was no other pressure on him, no telephones, no balabatim. Herman Wouk used to walk with him in the park. Then at about 2 o'clock, he would take leave, and he took a nap every day. And Rabbi Young said in public time and again, the secret to long life is taking a nap in the middle of the day. And Dov, I have to tell you, Rakefet signs on the dotted line. Herbie, when I came in Aliyah, a doctor, I don't even know his name, saved my life back in 1970. I came 69. And, you know, in America, I worked hard. I worked around the clock. And here, I would always be tired in the middle of the day. So my local doctor referred me to the outpatient clinic in Hadassah. And I go, and all my records and all this. And the doctor looks at it, examines me, and says to me, "Where were you raised?" I say, "In the Bronx." "Tell me, the Bronx is at sea level?" I say, "Yes." "Where are you living today?" "You're looking at Baharei Harim, Yerushalayim Harim Savivla." He says, "You have less oxygen. You have to take a nap. That's why we have a siesta." And in Israel at that time, Morty, do you remember this? Stores were closed between 2 to 4. 1:30 to 4, stores were closed. You're hearing Rabbi Rubin speak after living here 30 years. Okay, how many is he? 40 already? Wow, we played a role in bringing you 40 years. You're just 10 years behind us. Kanai Nahara. Beautiful. So he always took a nap in the middle of the day. But that's when you could talk with him. Now, I mentioned this before, but let me put it into context. Another person who loved Rabbi Young and owed his life to him in America was Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Berkowitz. Rabbi Young, the Jewish Center, they all played a role in bringing Rabbi Berkowitz to America. Dov, you know who Rabbi Berkowitz was? This was the Talmud Mufak of Hildesheim Seminary of Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg in the 1930s. He ran away to London, to England in the late 30s. He took the Kitvei Yad of Rabbi Weinberg, what Rabbi Weinberg gave him. Those Kitvei Yad, whenever the Blitz, and they had to run down to the metro, right, to the subway, or what they call it, a metro, way down in the ground, the underground, he took the Kitvei Yad with him. Later, after World War II, Rabbi Young brings him to America. And all these Kitvei Yad become the basis of the Sri Dayesh. The original Sri Dayesh publication goes back to the Kitvei Yad that he brought and saved during the Holocaust. So when he comes to America, he gets a shtela in the Boston area, and he's very unhappy. Here you're taking a man who is a great Talmud Chacham, who had a doctorate, and he's dealing with American balabatim far away from New York. And he would come in to see Rabbi Young and plead with him, "I'm so unhappy. Find me something I can." I think it was in Roxbury. Am I right? Right. And wow. And he was unhappy.
His two sons married Boston girls. Uh-huh. They were both my mother and
Benaki. Wow. And one son I know lives here.
The youngest one lives here, who is a professor of philosophy.
What's it? Dove? What's his name? Dove. And the other one, what is he? And what does the other one do?
One is a professor in Haifa in the Technion, and Shimon is a dentist in Boston.
Wow. So, in Brooklyn.
Is a neighborhood of Boston.
Right, I understand. The Rav lived in Roxbury.
Correct.
The Rav lived in Roxbury.
Maimonides was in Roxbury.
Right, no, then they tell the story. One time when the neighbor was changing, there was a shootout war on Shabbos between two gangs, and the Rav had to go to Mincha, and the people shooting it out knew who he was, and they said, no shooting till the Jewish bishop passes. And they stopped the shooting and allowed the Rav to walk the Shul to Mincha. But that's when the Rav knew it was time to move on to Brookline. And it was Rabbi Young who got Berkowitz the position in Chicago. And there he found himself. And of course, the stories afterwards, I told you it's not for now, with Rabbi Zimmerman and the dish that was thrown on Purim. But Rabbi Berkowitz found himself in Chicago. And later on, when he retired, he came in Aliyah and lived right between where I live and where Yitzchak lives on Rehov Chernachovsky. He was literally down
Shimoni the... number four.
Shimoni, he lived on Shimoni in that building. I used to meet him on Chernachovsky all the time. I used to meet him in the bank. So that's why I said Chernachovsky. He lived down the hill. He lived literally, Yitzchak lived further away than Rehov HaTkufa. And he lived on Shimoni and I lived on Berlin, all within walking distance.
One Shabbos I asked you when you were going to Shul, coming back to Shul, how can you say Asherim when it's praising God in the reality and it may be different? He said Asherim can be said not only is praise, but is bakasha.
That is a bakasha. Ashrei Yosha, halavai we should be zeicher to be Yoshvei Beitecha. Very nice, very nice.
I tell you the truth, it had a tremendous impact on my life.
He was heads and shoulders above the crowd. I gave many shurim on his work, on Ein Tanai B'Nesuin, his whole proposal, and, you know, it's the whole story with to solve the problem of Aguna. You got to hear my shurim. Maybe it's written up. I don't know. I have to think if it's been written up yet. But it's a tremendous undertaking. Rabbi Chil Yaakov wanted to give us Haskama, then the pressures, he asked his Talmud not to publish it. See, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg was caught between two worlds, and he was living in a little, he ran away from the world and hid in Switzerland. And there he could retain his membership in both the Haredi world, the yeshiva world, and the scientific world, the university world. But he always was afraid to rock the boat. And he told his Talmud not to publish his Haskama. But I will leave that for a different time. Here's an unbelievable quote, and this says it all. Rabbi Young had a formal appearance and bearing that reminded some of a German aristocrat. But his exterior melted quickly for acquaintances as well as old friends. And now they're quoting Rabbi Solomon J. Schaffman. Recognize the name? Rabbi Schaffman was a prince of the American rabbinate. He was not a YU person, although later in life everyone identified him with YU. He was a Chafetz Chaim graduate years and years ago from the original Chabura around the Leibowitz family. And he became rabbi of what was one of the most prominent Orthodox synagogues in New York at its time. The building was dedicated in 1929. We're going back, way back, 1929. Beautiful Moorish temple-like building right on a major street in Flatbush. Rabbi Revel attended the dedication. They called it a very important, a gold-lettered day in Orthodoxy in America that you now have such a beautiful building right in the heart of Brooklyn, which then was a major developing community. And Rabbi Schaffman was a prince of the rabbinate, Talmud Chacham, outstanding speaker, a man of dignity, raised a fabulous family with his wife. And Rabbi Schaffman recalls, quote, nobody called Leo Young Leo. Joseph Lookstein was Joe. Herbert Goldstein was Herbert. But Leo Young was Rabbi Young. And you see, this gives you a feeling of the man. We're talking about rabbis. What, a rabbi's going to call another rabbi rabbi? But Rabbi Joe Lookstein, the great Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein, Gilad Jeshlin. B'sof Shel Davar, he was Joe to his colleagues. Herbert Goldstein, you didn't call him Herbie, you called him Herbert. But Rabbi Young remained Rabbi Young. And this was the man, pulpit rabbi par excellence. A human being with insight, with kindness. I'll never forget our class with him in homiletics. Told us something very fascinating. His secretary kept a file of cards. Today you would do it in the computer. And every day when he came into his office, she would tell the rabbi, this one has a birthday today, this one has a birthday today. He would call. Secretary would call, the rabbi wants to speak to you, get on the phone and wish them a happy birthday. So you see, as famous as he was, and an international figure, but a fabulous pulpit rabbi. He knew his balabatim, the balabatim knew him. He was fortunate that the key balabatim were not just in Jewish center. They were in the center of the Jewish world, and this enabled him to be who he was. Now here, something beautiful. Memoir literature. Remember, we spoke about his scholarship. We'll come back to the scholarship in a few minutes. And maybe his greatest achievement was his translation of Tractate Yoma for Sansino. That's a fabulous piece of work on his part. Not all the translations are equal. I can tell you that I've used Sansino throughout the decades. All right, today it doesn't compare, in my opinion, to Steinsaltz, but not all translations are equal. They were all done by different individuals. But the one on Yoma, you can understand so clearly, it's a credit to him. Also, how he works to find the proper text. You feel it in his footnotes, his references. Many years later, they asked him to do the translation of Arakim. And while working on it, he was on in years already, he's working on it, and he's utilizing the library of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which was the biggest library close to where he lived on the Upper West Side. And they used this library all the time. You might ask a question, Mala Kohen Beveit HaKvara. So I can tell you, I write this up in Washington. When I was in high school, for the first time in my life, I had days off. Whoever had a day off from school? But MTA, for the first 2 years that I was there, still had a policy. If the teacher was going to give you 90 or over, you did not have to take finals. At the end of 2 years, they abolished it because they reached the conclusion that taking a test prepares you for life, prepares you for college. You have to take tests in life, you have to take exams. So we're not doing you a favor by exempting you. But the first 2 years, I had 2 weeks off between terms. Never in my life did I have time off. And the second year, my sophomore in MTA, this is 52, 53, with my chavrut, who was a year younger than me, Howie Noble, Chaim Noble, goes on to become a tremendous Talmud Chacham, but moves into the mere yeshiva world, not the YU world, which is his privilege and right. We're all going to vote tomorrow. You have a right to choose. So Chaim and I are making the rounds. There we go. Peyre Vadas, Chaim Berlin. And we then go to JTS. Come into JTS after being in the yeshiva. We want to see what Judaism is in New York. And we come into JTS. It's very different. There's no big base medrash. It's classrooms. It's all lectures. You don't see kids learning together, preparing. We're going to the world famous JTS library. And sitting in the library, don't have to quote anyone else but these eyes and these ears, there is Reb Moshe Bick working on some sefer. And I knew Reb Moshe Bick, the posek of the Bronx. I knew him quite well, the posek for Bnei Akiva. And I'm a kid of 14, 15, a chutzpan. I go over to Reb Moshe Bick. Rebbe, have a light fragen. Mala Kohen Beveit HaKfaran. And he looks at me and says, what's with you? In English, it's native language, born in Brooklyn or grew up in Brooklyn. Why you grad? What we call YU today? Why you mismach? Why you graduate? Because they have a rare sefer. I'm going to let them rob it from Klal Yisrael. Every right to be here and work with the rare sefarim they have. So that answers your question. He goes in time and again to Hebrew Union College. Time and again he goes in for their books. Now the librarian, Dr. Philip Miller, the librarian of the HUC, JII, Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, all this took place in the library. And he described the scene. Young was rather hard of hearing, and rather than talk in normal tones, he often bellowed. You know, people who don't hear well speak very loud because they want to hear what they're saying. They don't realize they're speaking too loud. Whenever he visited the library, like every other published author I know, he would carefully read every card in the catalog which had come in with his name on it. In other words, he would check, I've seen this, I don't do it myself, but I've seen people. The last time I saw him, he was at least 93 or 94, and had come to the library alone and unassisted via the subway to deliver his latest publication. He was going through the customary process of reviewing our holdings of his works and chatting with me, but in his loud chatting, was disturbing some of the people using the library. So I decided to get him away from the card catalog and to engage him in conversation. I asked him the same question I had asked him many times before. What was it like at the first Knesia Gedola v'Agudat Yisrael in Vienna in 1923 when you met the Chafetz Chaim? I always asked him that question, and he always replied as if he had never been asked it before and was waiting for someone to unlock the gate. His face lit up, and he described what Knesia Gedola was like, the rabbis who were there, but he saved his greatest joy for describing the Chafetz Chaim. His description was nothing extraordinary, but what Rabbi Young obviously delighted in recounting was that the Chafetz Chaim looked him square in the eyes and said to him in Yiddish that he, parentheses, Young, was going to bring Yiddishkeit to America and he was going to save American Jewry from assimilation and disappearance. Once that was done, Rabbi Young returned to the card catalog and to his rather loud style of talking. There were two young Orthodox New York University students sitting at a large table which meant to be used for group study and therefore normal talking. They shushed Rabbi Young, who paid them no attention because he could not hear them. They shushed him several times over a minute or two. Seeing that they did not recognize him, I went over to them and said, quote, boys, isn't it wonderful? Look at him. At 94, Rabbi Young made a special visit down here to present us with his latest publications, end quote. The boys sat there amazed, staring at the elderly rabbi. Just then, Rabbi Young called me over and announced all for all to hear that he was finished looking at the catalog and was going back uptown. He faced the circulation desk, and cupping his hands backwards, European style, he waved and bellowed his customary au revoir. Always au revoir, never auf Wiedersehen or goodbye. The two young men got up from their chairs and was breaking their ankles in the process as they tripped over themselves and each other to get to the exit. Rabbi Young, may we walk you to the train, they asked. And the three of them left. I completely forgot about them until some 4 hours later, when I was sitting in my office doing paperwork, there was a knock at my door, and it was the two boys. They had only just returned from escorting Rabbi Young to the West 4th Street subway station with a leisurely stop at a bench in Washington Square Park. These boys had come by to thank me for having given them the schus of meeting Rabbi Young, the religious exemplar for them. And isn't that a beautiful description and a beautiful way for us to say au revoir to Rabbi Dr. Leo Young?
Just if you could find, what was his name?
The librarian?
Miller.
Miller, but I'll give you the exact name, Dr. Philip Miller. And you see, Rabbi Young had used his library regularly. They say when he worked on Yoma, that's where he got the manuscripts. That's where he got cross-references. Evidently, this library at the time was bigger than Gottesman, and it was closer and easier for him to use than the JTS library. And here he is, later years, and here he comes in, and here are these two kids. They write New York University students, could be their Yeshiva College students, could be NYU students, Frum kids, could be Columbia University doing research, kippah on their head, but they already knew Vayakum Da Chadash. Who knew Rabbi Young? Who could recognize him? But the name they knew, the person they knew, and what a schut for them. These kids are probably telling it to their grandchildren today that they walked Rabbi Young to the subway station, the park, if you know what we're talking about, that's downtown NYU, the big park there, Washington Square, the subway station. What a schut. Let me end off in this description of Rabbi Young. At the end is the whole appendix on his scholarship. And here, the most famous contribution he made, and this Yitzchak and I can testify, the series on, it was called On Judaism in General. These books, during his lifetime, there were 8 or 9 afterwards. It's called the Jewish Library. Am I right, Yitzchak? That was the name they used. These books were fabulous. Now, he didn't write everything in the books. There are four different volumes of biographies of Gedolei Yisrael. And he edited, he wrote a few of the biographies, but he got many people to contribute. There are books on the Jewish holidays. There are books on Jewish philosophy. These books at that time were epic making. You don't start to understand there was no art scroll. Jewish Publication Society was totally in the hands of the conservative movement. There was nothing available. This was epic making. Already in the 1930s, books are starting to appear in proper English, in a high-class English, about Yiddishkeit, explaining Tarat Mishpachar, explaining Shabbos, explaining Kashrut, talking about the great Rabbanim, and he, across the board, the great Litvisha Rabbanim, the great Hasidic Rabbanim, the Musa movement. Some of these books have beautiful articles, translation, Rabbi Chil Yaakov's writings on the Muslim movement, and the great German Rabbanim. Across the board, this man made available to the Torah public in the United States, ultimately the whole world, volumes that had never, ever appeared before. People could dream about it. He brought it to reality. Later, after his death, Sansino reprints these volumes, and there's more material from his archives. They wind up with, instead of 7-8 volumes, 9 or 10, but these volumes live on. Particularly the biographical volumes, I consult them all the time. He has a beautiful piece on Sarah Schneera. He has a magnificent piece on the Chafetz Chaim, on Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski, one after another, on the Hildesheimer family. There's no end to what he has, and it's proper English, sources, well-written. All right, nowadays I know someone is working on a biography of Rabbi Chaim Isa. It'll be a beautiful biography. It'll supersede anything written before. But this was spade work when these volumes did not have a large reading public. You had to raise money to dedicate them, to publish them. But this was Rabbi Young. With his translations on Yoma, which they say was second to none. What's notable about the translations is here is a man who comes from Hildesheimer, where totally opposed, he's a Talmud of Rav David Zvi Hoffman, totally opposed to any critical analysis of the text of the Chumash, of the Tanakh, and time and again he quotes his Rebbe, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, that this issue of what is the proper text is not open to discussion. We believe that every word is given Torah Kibbil Moshe Mi-Sinai, but when it came to Talmud, he was much more open to emendations, a correct text. He consults Digdike Sofrim, that's Reb Natan Netta Rabinovich, that's a Talmud of a Musmach of Reb Yitzchak Kahn Spector, who did the tremendous work in giving us a proper text of the Talmud. We have the work downstairs, consults him all the time, consults other manuscripts, and they said to him, my high, that here with the Daf Gemara, you're willing to rework it and revise it, and Chumash you will not touch? And his answer was very simple. Torah Shebechtav is Maimon HaSinai. But Torah Shebaal Peh, which was passed on by heart until they wrote it down, the Gemara and Gittin, Daf Samech, he says, here, as long as your interpretation is in accordance with tradition, it's absolutely permissible. And I need not tell you, when you study Maimonides, the Rambam, time and again, you notice Maimonides gives a different psak, the halacha, look into the Rambam, different than Rashi, different than Tosfot. And you look into the Nosei Kalim, the Rambam had a different text, had a different text of the Gemara. And you see that time and time again. And therefore, I have every right to research and try to come up with the proper text. And by the way, I don't know how familiar he was, but this was the Avodat HaMelech, Mori Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik's uncle, the Avodat HaMelech, Lo Aleinu. He wrote a parish on the Rambam from start to finish. It was all lost in the Shoah. All that we have is what he published on the first two volumes of the Mishnah Torah, Sefer Mada Ve'ahava. That's all we have today because there was no money to publish anymore. That was published in the early 30s, right after his death. His wife had the manuscript. It never showed up again. After the Holocaust, everyone was wiped out, and what a loss that was. But what was unique about the Avodat HaMelech was here too, he tried to establish proper texts in understanding why the Rambam paskened what he did. All right, so halacha lemaisa, we have completed, and if we were to summarize these last number of lectures on Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, I'll do like we do in davening. Shabbos morning, we start with Adon Olam, and 3.5 hours later, we finish with Adon Olam. And I'll tell you a vort from the Rav. Why do we start with Adon Olam, end with Adon Olam? And the Rav said a beautiful vort, because as much as we davened, we really haven't davened enough. But we're only human beings. We can't wind up davening and not doing anything else in life. But it's symbolic. We began with Adon Olam, and with all that we said and davened and shuckled and cried and laughed, we finished with Adon Olam. So I want to end off these lectures with exactly the way we began a number of weeks ago. Quote, what did Rabbi Young accomplish? He sold Orthodox Judaism to the children of the Jazz Age. Remember my quoting it? We quote it again. And we finished him out today, the personality, the person, the man, his Talmidim, his admirers, his accomplishments, Poli Agudat Yisrael. And we have set the stage for Rabbi Dr. Joseph Kamenetsky, which a side view of Dr. Kamenetsky and Leo Young, and an important name that should be mentioned. And I have in this case, which I cannot show you today, but when we do Rabbi with Dr. Kamenetsky, we will call in Brinks to guard us. I will show you a very interesting little volume that, believe me, I'm not entirely certain how I got it, but we have preserved it over the decades. Now, there's a lot to give out. Hold on 1 second. I want to clear the closet as much as I can. This is a printout of the Star K Comprehensive Guide for Pesach. It's 2019. It's very fascinating. Gives you a little insight into kashrut in America and what concerns them. If anyone wants it, you're welcome to it.
You didn't review the topics you covered today. Did you want
to? I just reviewed a second ago. I spoke about Poli Agudah. I spoke about the personality. I spoke about the admirers. We just reviewed and set the stage for a week after Pesach. Now, in addition, this is a printout of an article that appeared a number of years ago, Legal Theology, The Turn to Conceptualism in 19th Century Jewish Law by Chaim Saiman, Villanova Law School. He evidently teaches there. This is an article, you have to have a legal mind. It compares the Chidushim of Reb Chaim to Reb Shimon Shkup. It's just amazing what people are doing today. Shai Wozner, recognized the name, just did a PhD at Hebrew U. It's just been published on Reb Shimon Shkup from a legal point of view. A sub-Talmud of mine in America, Micha Berger, just published on Reb Shimon Shkup his Hashkafa. A Talmud, Normie Gold, bought the book for me already. I'll get it this summer when I'll be in the States. If anyone's interested, fabulous article. Here's an article by Chaim Saiman, the same person. What happens in heaven? Study of what? What is God doing in heaven? What are the people doing in heaven? And here you see that the rabbis of the Talmud frequently described heaven through the image of God's throne. And in one particular text, the Talmud presents a picture of heaven quite unlike anything in the Bible, and an image that is indeed unthinkable. And he describes from the Gemara in Bava Metzia how they're arguing over halacha in heaven. Very interesting article. Our articles, you all know a first temple seal was just discovered. The implications are unbelievable. Why don't our politicians quote the Bible that God gave us this land? Why must we be subject every day that we rob the land, we're thieves? Quote the Bible, solve the problem, at least to a certain degree. This is about Rabbi Landau, who just died, the Landau Heksha. It's the Chabad family, and his heksha is recognized all over the world. Very interesting pictures, pictures of him with the Rebbe, as Chabad can do, the pictures they come up with. This is also the same thing Rabbi Landau. This is on the Skulener Rebbe, who just died. And I don't have to tell you, he and his father, Tzadikim Yisodei Olam, under the communists, how they kept Yiddishkeit alive in Romania. Tzadikim Yisodei Olam. It's a big, big loss. But all right, he was well into his 90s. We should all not pass on any younger. This is an unbelievable story from Seagate, New York. Satmar rented space from Chabad, and now Satmar evicted Chabad from the building. It's going to go to court. It's unbelievable what we Jews are capable of, and we should all be believing in the same Torah. This is very big news now. Liberal Orthodox yeshiva says will not ordain gay students. And I just explained to someone this morning, here's a student studying at Chovevei Torah, fine mind, everything good, not only gay, but publicly living with his gay partner. So do you give him smicha? And Chovevei Torah is shaking, they refuse to give him smicha, and there's big machlekes now, pro and con, two copies of the article. Here is an article from London, very fascinating. The woman who wrote the article is a well-known writer. She was married to a Jew for 15 years. They got divorced but remained friendly. The usual story of modern life. Art thou contented Jew, about anti-Semitism, but you see her attitude towards Israel. She's not anti-Semitic, far from it, but we robbed the land of the Arabs. It is just unbelievable. Very fascinating article. I think that's a picture of Rubens Restaurant, 1977 in London, when they celebrated Her Majesty's 25th celebration on the throne, and it says Mazel Tov to Her Majesty. You see, and Yomo, two more copies. Shavatayachol Lishlopi Evrit Vigam Imatamoset Zahala Bavakasha. My dear students, I want to wish everyone a Chag Hashem Sameach. For frum people, you have to say a Chag Sameach for Kasher, because if you would know the way my wife cleans for Pesach, I finally beat her down yesterday and said, what are you doing this one? I had to help her. She's handing me dishes up and down and down and up. Clothing. She says, no, it's not for Pesach, but you got to clean the house once a year. So this is part of the cleaning. So for Purim, we have to say Chag Kasher Sameach. But for Pesach, we have to say Chag Sameach v'Kasher. A week after Pesach ends, in other words, that's Sunday, Monday, there are no classes. Sunday, Monday afterwards, we open up for the final stretch. Be'ezrat Hanatein le'yav koach. Yitzchak, I hope you're not upset with me that I left the topic yesterday. We will come back to it in dignity. A world to do yet. But we had to do what we did yesterday so the Rebbe could go on living. And my grandsons, remember, they're the ones who called me all excited. Mentioned on the Israeli, they go out with girls. My grandson now with the girl, they're going to get engaged soon. He apologizes to her. He says, yes, they went to hear some great Rabbanim speak for this girl. I'd love for this rabbi to sub their condition. So my grandson has to tell her, no, no, no. My grandfather's Masada Kedushin, he's a great rabbi among the Americans. You follow? Has to apologize to me. But here, they mentioned in Galei Tzahal. All right, let me spell it out. And Baruch Hashem, I feel so much better that I was able to get it off my chest. You have no idea. All right, we should only have Besorah Tovot. It should be a Chodesh Tov and a Meredith Pesach. Und der Chag soll nicht sein versteht. Ribbono shel Olam, Ashrei Yoshvei Vetecha, listen to me. No bad news. And then we'll meet again right afterwards and pick up where we left off. I want to say best regards. Thank you to all in front of me. and all my greetings to my sub-students listening across the world until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya.
2 days Rosh Chodesh. Sunday, Monday, 2 days Rosh Chodesh.
Right. All right. 2 days
Rosh Chodesh.
So, bring a chicken to him. He says, come back in a half hour. Come back in a half hour. Great. Next week, same thing. Come back in a half hour. Next week, you bring a cow. Come back in a half hour. Great. In Europe, it's the tarpa, the cow.
Right. Tremendous loss.
So the Baal Bata comes and says, Rebbe, we don't understand.
You on the way?
Personally, how can everything be traced? Exactly what is it?
Half hour.
Yeah. He says,
I don't think so.
So then we can go.
Charge it up, get us apart. I know perfectly. Tarfus, I know what this says. Ubasam said it's over. I can't believe it's over. I can't believe it's over.
So I'll tell you the other version of that story, that this grim Jew who's always in this inn, and a muskil comes in, Yomo, take the cakes, and this grim Jew, this muskil sees they always send the kids to the shine, and the muskil says,